Let's do the refuge in bodhicitta on page 8. In Buddha, Dharma, and supreme spiritual community, we go for refuge until fully enlightened by the power of all six perfections, from generosity to non-dual wisdom. For the sake of all beings, may we realize Buddhahood. Allow the body to settle into a natural, easy posture. If you wish, use the breath to release and relax, taking a few slow, deep breaths, breathing in and letting go. Breathing in and letting go. Breathing in and just letting go. And then with the body, the breath coming easily, relaxed, just raise the gaze slightly. Look ahead of you in an unfocused, relaxed way. And be aware that there's awareness. Be aware of the body in the space of awareness. Be aware of the breath in the space of awareness. Be aware of the environment, sounds, arising and passing away within the space of awareness. And be aware of thoughts and images and feelings, mental phenomena, but also arise and pass away within the space of awareness. open to all these phenomena which represent the entire range and realm of experience. Open to them all and let them come and go within the boundless space of mind, of awareness. Sensations, thoughts, feelings, sounds arise and pass away. But what is continuous in each and every moment is awareness. And if you get distracted, just relax and come back, or just recognize you're already here. There always already is awareness. So we investigated last night some of the things that allow us to optimize retreats, some of the advice that wise people have given us over the centuries. And one of the things we talked about was the possibility of reflecting on certain themes and ideas that provide inspiration and insight. And in the Tibetan tradition, there are four ideas that have been thought of classically as being especially potent in their power to open and awaken us, to motivate us, and to inspire us to practice. These are the so-called four mind changes. And they have multiple functions. One of them is motivational. And if after this week you decide you'd like to do the classic, do a little more practice and sign up for the classic Tibetan three-year, three-month, three-day retreat, then what you will do, one of the challenges, of course, is going to be keeping up motivation. And so how do you inspire yourself to do full-on continuous practice for 3 years, 3 months, 3 days? Well, one of the things you do, you spend much of the first month reflecting on the four thoughts, the four mind changes, these ideas which are thought to be so deep and profound and opening us to reality and also motivational. So that would be how you could keep yourself going through one way of inspiring yourself to do that kind of practice and to make it through 3 years, 3 months, 3 days. Not that you would be counting, of course. Lama Surya, just to give you, put things in perspective, as I recall him describing his first three-year retreat. So part of the way they work is that there's a sealing-in ceremony that a Tibetan makimak, putting it in technical terms, comes and does a sealing-in ceremony. You're not allowed outside the confines of the monastery until the makimak comes back 3 years, 3 months, 3 days later and unseals the monastery and you come out. Except the retreat was the makimak. I hope I don't get into the bad reincarnations for using this term. The Tibetan elder, shall we say, was working on Tibetan time, so actually arrived 6 months late. But what's another 6 months? So you might want to be motivated to practice for longer than 3 years, 3 months, 3 days. But no matter what amount of time we're doing in retreat, motivation's an issue. It's an issue in retreat. It's an issue out of retreat. It's a recurrent theme. And of course, there are cycles. Sometimes we feel wonderfully inspired and practice is effortless. At other times, we feel decidedly uninspired, drab, dry. And then we look for ways to enhance our motivation. And one of the ways of enhancing motivation is not so much through willpower and struggle. There are times when that's appropriate, but it's particularly in this practice, struggle and strain is counter-effective. It gets in the way. We want to come from a place of inner inspiration and to practice with ease. And so what the four mind changes are designed to do is that help us look very closely at our lives. And as we look very closely at our lives and the nature of life, we see that we see deeply into reality. And the more deeply and clearly we see into reality, the more we recognize that practice is a very skillful way to spend our lives. Now, most people don't look very closely at life, at themselves, at our existential condition, at the challenges that life provides us, or at reality. In fact, most people, and certainly some, and sometimes us, prefer to live in illusion and to avoid looking very deeply at life. And as I spoke of last night, we avoid looking deeply into life both by ourselves with our individual defense mechanisms and avoidance strategies and distractors, and as a collective enterprise. One interesting way of looking at culture is that culture serves many, many functions, some of them wonderful, some of them absolutely essential for survival and our well-being and learning and education, etc., etc. And once you develop some spiritual insight, you see that culture also functions as a collective avoidance mechanism, a way of avoiding us looking deeply into the nature of life. This is what I mentioned last night in the philosopher Kierkegaard's terms, tranquilization by the trivial. Now, that can be pleasantly narcotizing in the short term, but in the long term, it's a guarantee of suffering, and we only have to look around at the world around us to see the proof of that. Because the problem is, when we live in illusion rather than reality, then our lives are not appropriate to reality. They're not skillful. Remember, I introduced the term skillful from a Buddhist use of the term skillful. An act is skillful to the extent that it tends to enhance the well-being and reduce the suffering of everyone, including oneself. And as we see and understand reality more clearly and accurately, we automatically, spontaneously tend to act more appropriately and skillfully. In fact, this is one of the central goals of spiritual practice and spiritual life, to see more clearly and sensitively and deeply into life, into ourselves, and therefore to be able to respond more skillfully and appropriately to life. So, how does one do this? Well, of course, one does one's spiritual practice. And specifically, one of the supreme ways of seeing clearly into the nature of existence and reality and life is meditation. And so this practice, these practices we're doing, are superb ways of looking into life, looking into ourselves, looking into reality. And there are others, and one of those is reflection. To reflect on profound statements about the nature of life and reality. Statements which call us to look and remind us of the nature of life. So, Tibetan Buddhists suggest that there are four thoughts, four ideas that are really worth devoting time to reflecting on. And they are called the four mind changes because they really do change one's mind and life. The first is that what is called a free and well-favored life is a priceless opportunity. Free and well-favored life is a priceless gift, a priceless opportunity. The second mind changer second idea is that life is short and death is certain. The third is that our ethical choices mold our lives. And the fourth is that life contains inevitable difficulties. Now, you'll recognize this is the first noble truth, often translated badly as life is suffering. The technical Pali term is dukkha. Life is dukkha. And dukkha is a far more subtle and sophisticated concept, which I've seen at least 30 nuances to it. And it certainly does not imply that life is only suffering. In fact, our practice is designed to cultivate, among other things, qualities such as happiness and joy. It's a much more nuanced idea, pointing to the idea that unenlightened living in illusion, invariably involves dissatisfaction of some kind. Obviously, this would be worth a whole talk, and at another time, maybe we will. Now, these ideas, these four mind changes, have tremendous transformative capacity for several reasons. First is, they're accurate reflections of reality. This, according to the wisest people who've ever landed on the planet, is the way life is. This is the way awakened people see the world and life. Second, they're not only accurate reflections of reality, but they are deep and profound reflections of reality. And that means that they can be appreciated at deeper and deeper levels. And that as we keep reflecting on them, more and more insights and implications unveil themselves. That is, these are not the ABCs of Buddhism. These are profound ideas, and like any profound idea, they contain depths which we recognize to the extent of our own development and maturation. And this is an ancient idea, perhaps the best known summary in the West is the words of Jesus, "Let those who have ears to hear, hear." When he was speaking about, he was telling these parables, and the parables have many depths and levels to them. What we hear is dependent on our own spiritual maturation and spiritual work. To introduce a technical term from philosophy, they have what are called higher grades of significance. That is, there are higher meanings inherent in them. Perhaps the best way of illustrating this is with a story. Imagine that an animal in the jungle finds this curious object. It's dark and light and has a very curious smell, not totally novel smell, and it tastes lousy, totally inedible, useless. And then a native from a tribal culture finds it and has an experience of being very puzzled. It's a very curious thing. It's black and white, and it opens and closes and has these curious marks on. And then, being a very brilliant woman, she makes an incredibly useful discovery. She discovers it's wonderful for starting fires. And then a child from a literate culture discovers it and finds, oh, it's a book. But the kid can't read, so it doesn't have any meaning to it. And then an adult finds it, and it's a book, and opens it and starts reading. It's a book, but it's totally ridiculous. It's obviously written by some crazy person. It makes no sense whatsoever. And then a physicist opens it and finds it's a profound text on quantum physics and realizes that it gives extraordinary insights into the nature of reality. And then a physicist who's also a contemplative opens it and realizes, yes, it's a text on quantum physics, and it gives a description of matter and material at a very deep level. But it has no appreciation of other realms of existence, of the nature of consciousness, or the implications and role of consciousness in that. Now, there are some interesting things about what that animal and those people recognized. Each of them was actually correct in what they observed. The animal was right. It smelled funny and tasted lousy. The woman was right. It was great for starting fires. The kid was right. It was a book. So each of them observed something and was accurate in what they observed and was unaware that they were missing deeper, more profound meanings or so-called higher grades of significance. And what the wise people of the world have been telling us throughout history is that that's how we are with life. That there are deeper levels of understanding of life available to us. There are higher grades of significance. And that what we recognize and appreciate in life, what we understand, what we recognize, is a function of our level of spiritual maturation. So these four mind changes can be appreciated at different levels. And Tibetan wise people tell us that these are worth reflecting on over long periods of time. Reflecting on intellectually, meditating on, and appreciating in their depths. And they operate like koans. A koan is a question, and again, remember the distinction I think I mentioned last night, the difference between informational questions and wisdom questions. Information questions have a one-time answer. Is it raining outside? Nope. End of question. But wisdom questions are bottomless. Each time you ask them, they take you deeper into yourself and into reality and into life. So these are questions like our sacred questions or our sacred values. What do I want to do with my life, etc.? What do I most value? So the four mind changes are like koans. So what I want to focus on today is the first of these, the idea that a free and well-favored life is a priceless opportunity. Now, there are various ways into this, but take a moment again, as we did last night, to reflect on just everything that has to come together before we can be on retreat like this. We have to be in a society which has it together, which can provide food and supplies and shelter. We have to have freedom of religious expression and practice. We have to have people who are supporting us. We have to have health. We have to have freedom. We have to have time, sufficient resources, money, etc., etc. So there's a lot. And we are here because we have what the Tibetans called free and well-favored lives. So what is a free and well-favored life? Well, it's free of things and it's favored with things. It's free of things like sickness and disease and disability and oppression. All the impediments which could get in the way of our being able to practice. And it's well favored with having time and livelihood and freedom and teachings and techniques available to us. And it's amazing to think, I mean, you know, living in California, it's hard to realize how extraordinarily rare it is to have this kind of privilege. Let me ask, how many of you practice more than one spiritual tradition? Most of you. So now you realize that throughout most of history you would have ended up in a funeral pyre. Okay. I mean, it's extraordinarily rare to even have the freedom to do what we're doing here, let alone to have the time and the health and the resources and so forth, let alone to have the teachings. I mean, we couldn't, you know, just a few, for many of us in our lifetime, these teachings wouldn't have been available in the West. You know, our teachers, like Lama Surya, trekked to Asia to get these and bring them back for us. That's the reason we have them. This is an extraordinary time. Ken Wilber, whose work many of you will know, said he was talking about California. He said, you know, I can't think of a time since Alexandria 2,000 years ago since there was such a meeting of the world's traditions and such an availability of practices. So this is very rare. Now, I want to do a meditation or reflection. You can do it as either a meditation, sitting in meditation, or you can do it with your eyes open and just let it wash through you. And I want to do a meditation reflection on comparing our lives with most people, and most people have lived throughout history, and just bring home how fortunate our own lives are, just bringing home this idea of our free and well-favored lives. Now, I do this, but I want to also provide a context and a warning. There are skillful and unskillful ways of doing these kinds of comparisons. And there are traps and there are benefits. One can respond to an appreciation of our good fortune in two ways. One can respond with either guilt or gratitude. Okay. So let me just say a little bit about those options. I'm going to recommend gratitude. Because I want to suggest that it's easy to get into guilt about this. And I want to suggest that guilt is... how much to get into this. Guilt is not a helpful emotion. And that guilt can be one of the most painful and destructive of human emotions. And I want to suggest something which one can only talk about in a spiritually mature community. I want to suggest that at a certain stage of life, of spiritual maturation, guilt is a destructive and unnecessary emotion. Yes, it serves a function during childhood and adolescence, etc., and it keeps a lot of, you know, it keeps us as kids and adolescents and a lot of adults from doing a lot of stupid things. But it's also at a great cost, because guilt comes with a lot of pain and suffering, which usually is spread out onto other people. The saying goes, guilt is the gift which keeps on giving. Now, I need to make a distinction here because in Buddhist psychology, there's a distinction between regret and guilt. Regret over our unethical actions can be very appropriate, motivate us to make reparations and correct them. But guilt is regret plus self-attack. And that is not helpful. Okay? And there comes a time in one's spiritual life when one has worked with ethics and cultivated one's mind and heart and is living with integrity and ethicality, where guilt, it is entirely appropriate to let go and relinquish guilt. But that can't be done as long as you believe you think you need it. Okay? You can't relinquish the guilt until you recognize it is no longer necessary or appropriate. Okay? So you need to know that at a certain stage, guilt is no longer helpful. Okay. So, in reflecting on our good fortune and comparing ourselves with others, the emphasis is not, this is a practice which can cultivate two skillful responses. One is compassion. Another is gratitude. And out of that, and also there are actually other skillful responses. One is the desire to commit one's life. Well, actually, there are several other skillful responses. We'll get into those in a little while. But there's a skillful desire to commit one's life to awakening in order to better serve others. So I just want to reflect for a few minutes then on our free and well-favored lives and what most people deal with. So you can sit in meditation or you can just allow this to wash through. Just take a moment to breathe and relax. And recall the fact that at this moment, there are hundreds of millions of people who are struggling even to get enough food and nutrition to survive. So ours is a very fortunate situation. And there are hundreds of millions of others who are suffering from illness of various kinds, the point where they wouldn't have the health or energy to practice. And there are hundreds of millions of people who are enfeebled by old age, who don't have the energy or mobility to come to a retreat and practice. And there are millions of people in war-torn societies who would not be able to find a place of safety and sanctuary such as we have. And there are literally billions of people living in poverty without the resources necessary to take a retreat. And there are very, very few who understand that the source of happiness and well-being is within. And there are extremely few who appreciate that the mind and heart can be cultivated. And the vast majority of people are living in illusion, not knowing there's another way, not knowing it's possible to wake up. And there are very few people who have a community like this, who have found like-minded souls to assist and inspire their practice. So ours is a very, very rare circumstance. A free and well-favored life is a very, very rare thing. And it is entirely appropriate to feel deep gratitude for this. Not just much deeper than an egoic satisfaction with our good luck, but a deep gratitude for this priceless gift. And given how extraordinarily and exquisitely rare and fortunate this opportunity is, this free and well-favored life and this chance to practice, what do you most want to do with your life? And given how exquisitely rare and priceless this free and well-favored life is, what qualities do you most want to cultivate? And given this exquisite gift, what contributions do you want to make to the world? And given this remarkable gift, what is your unique gift to the world? And given this remarkable gift, what do you most want to learn? When you're ready, just bring your awareness back to the room. And just take a moment. Were there any answers that emerged for anyone that you'd like to share? Keeping in mind that what may emerge out of these kind of questions are very deep inspirations, and that sharing them can be a way in which each of us, all of us, can be inspired. So if anyone feels like sharing anything that came up, please feel free, no obligation.
The last item you mentioned, what do you most want to learn? The question that kept popping through my head almost daily when I was in my 30s, 40s, and 50s was, Why am I here? What is my most important thing to do? And even now, it'll pop up maybe every 3 weeks.
Beautiful. So that's your sacred question.
My name is Wendy. I'm already doing what I think I'm supposed to be doing, and I love it. But I arrived at it through a great deal of struggle with addiction. And now I have been able to turn all of that around so that I am now treating people with addiction.
Beautiful. Yes.
And what is unique that I can bring to it, a lot of people can bring their struggle with addiction and be trained as a psychotherapist or an addiction counselor, social worker. But what helps to make my contribution unique is my interest in Buddhism and mindfulness, but also my Buddha nature, which I am slowly starting to discover here and for which I am very grateful. And I was also very grateful for your comments on guilt. I try to tell some of my clients that guilt is a wasted emotion. It depletes your soul. I feel enormously grateful for what I've been able to do and what I continue to do. And this is just like icing on the cake. What I want to learn is to continue to learn what I'm learning today.
Wonderful. Nice example that our challenges, one of the great transformations of our challenges is to use them as our gifts. Yeah. Thank you.
I want to become aware of the gifts that I receive from people I've never seen before and people I'll probably never see again, and then I can become more and more aware. And I want to become more and more aware of a little child's smile that I can stay in the moment.
Thank you. So
ironically, when you said free and favored, well-favored life, I thought that was the thing that was most worth spending your life on, is giving more of a free and well-favored life to others.
Ah, beautiful. Thank you. Okay. So these are beautiful examples of the kind of recognition and that can come from this kind of reflection. All of them pointing to specific individual ways of responding to the question, how do we make optimal use of our free and well-favored lives? And so once we begin to really appreciate how rare the gift we have is, just to have these teachings. I mean, you know, just a few decades ago, we would have had to trek up Himalayan mountains and be put through 30 years of spiritual boot camp before we'd even hear of Dzogchen. I mean, it's very hard to recognize just how rare this experience we're having here is. When I first started practicing in Buddhism, you know, teachers wouldn't talk about this. And this is very rare. So the questions that emerge once we begin to appreciate gifts, these free and well-favored lives we have, the questions that kind of tend to come up are questions such as, what are skillful ways of responding to our good fortune? And these questions are all different facets of the same thing. But what do we do with our free and well-favored lives? Okay, somehow or other, we ended up with these extraordinary lives. What do we do with them? And there are three classic answers. The first we're talking about, gratitude. To literally, gratitude. The second is to awaken. And the third is to serve. To awaken, to be grateful, to cultivate gratitude, to awaken and to serve. Now, not just, oh, there's more to this than just, oh, I have this fantastic life, how wonderful. There's actually a suggestion that we cultivate gratitude, that we reflect on this, because gratitude is an extremely healthy mind state. Gratitude offers multiple benefits. First, it creates happiness. Second, it creates contentment, that is, satisfaction with what we have. It reduces the tendency that which is inherent in the untrained mind to keep looking outside for more and better and different, and to spend and waste our lives seeking and paying for variations on touch and feel and sight and sound, which is basically what most people's lives are spent seeking and spending on. So contentment. It reduces fear. Gratitude reduces fear. Gratitude also reduces a very specific fear. It reduces the fear of love. When we are grateful, there is an automatic desire to share, to give, to help, to heal. And that is associated with love. But there's also if, and this is an experiment you can try for yourself, just notice when you feel grateful, you are more open to love. And finally, it cultivates generosity. This desire to share one's good fortune. And ultimately, what happens with the deeper one's growth, the greater one's spiritual maturity, the fuller the awakening. With that comes a reduction of one's own suffering. And then what calls is the suffering of the world. So that with one's own suffering reduced, or in rare awakened beings' case, released completely, what calls then is the suffering of the world. What would one want to do except help others come to one this fortunate state that you have? So we cultivate gratitude as a practice. And there are ways of doing this, and this is one of the ways of cultivating gratitude, to reflect on our free and well-favored lives. So we cultivate gratitude, and then we come back to the question, what's the best use I can make of this life? And the answer that spiritual traditions in general, and our Buddhist tradition in particular, gives us is to awaken and to serve. That is, wise people recommend that once we get our good fortune, that we use that to motivate, inspire ourselves to practice so that we go, so that we awaken. And that the optimal use of life is to free oneself from illusions, to open oneself to reality, to recognize who one really is, to discover one's true nature. In short, to awaken. And it is wise people state very clearly that this is not a selfish enterprise, that this is enlightened self-interest, that to awaken ourselves is a way of optimally serving others, because we can only free people from the roots of suffering to the extent that we have ourselves have seen into and understood and seen through and released ourselves from the roots of suffering. Now, of course, we can, and if we look out at the world, it's very interesting to recognize that for the first time in human history, most of the great issues we face are actually human-caused. And that at this stage, with our enormous technological power, the state of the world reflects the state of our minds. And that the hunger and warfare and deprivation and ecological destruction we see around us is actually a reflection of the psychological and spiritual immaturity within us and the dysfunctions between us. So that the state of the world actually reflects the state of our minds. And yes, it is absolutely appropriate and important and essential to feed the hungry and to work against oppression and to try to save the environment. And these are symptoms. They're not the root cause. These are symptoms of our individual and collective psycho-spiritual immaturity. So if we are to work at the deepest level, if we are to truly cure and not apply band-aids, and it is totally appropriate to apply band-aids, but if we are to heal at the deepest level, we need to be able to reduce the psychological immaturity, the destructive states of mind that are creating the suffering and destruction in the world. That's the deepest and most powerful and profound healing. And that is what this practice offers us. It offers us the opportunity and the inspiration to heal the sick and help the and to feed the hungry, etc., etc., and to simultaneously work to alleviate and heal the spiritual dysfunction that has caused them. So we are encouraged to use our free and well-favored lives to awaken and to serve. And to serve in ways which speak to and address and attempt to heal and help at the deepest possible level of causation of suffering. So those are our two primary functions, but there's another one that's recommended, that's essential. And that is to develop certain skills and capacities in ourselves, skills and capacities which are known in Buddhism as skillful means. And skillful means are those means which are most effective for reducing suffering, enhancing well-being, and optimizing awakening. So here then are the three things which wise people recommend we do with our lives. That we devote ourselves to awakening, to serving, and to cultivating skillful means. And this, of course, is the bodhisattvic aspiration. This is bodhicitta. The bodhisattvic aspiration to devote one's life to the welfare and awakening of all beings. The highest ideal, which as far as I can see anyway, from looking across the world's traditions, the highest ideal which the human mind has ever conceived of. Encompassing all ideals. I mean, is there any other ideal, real ideal, positive ideal, which isn't encompassed within this? Doesn't mean we can't do our art or our sport or anything which brings joy into our lives will enhance our capacity to give joy to others. Who wants to be helped by someone who's dour and no fun to be around? So it doesn't, and it is, and that actually points to a very important distinction in service. That is, service done from an optimal spiritual perspective is a source of joy and not a sacrifice. If you are serving out of sacrifice, that is feedback you're missing something. Okay. My wife and I have a very curious, we have a lot of agreements, but we have one that strikes most people as very weird. And that is, don't do me any favors. If you would like to do something for me, wonderful, here I am. But don't do me any favors out of a sense of sacrifice. We can't afford it. You know, you will, if you do that for me, you will feel resentful, and I will end up feeling eventually unhappy too. We can't afford that. But to the extent we can serve each other joyfully and out of appreciation of what an exquisite joy it is to be able to help someone, what a priceless privilege it is to be able to help in any way possible, then we both experience joy. So it's very important to distinguish between service and sacrifice. Okay? Service, when done skillfully, is enlightened self-interest. Okay? So then comes the question, how do we cultivate skillful means? How do we develop and cultivate ourselves so as to be optimal instruments of service? Optimal instruments, even more than that, optimal instruments of service and of awakening. And remember, this is a wisdom question. It's not a question which you are going to find a one-time answer to, or anyone, certainly not me, is going to be able to give you an answer to. No one can point to you and say, do this. What we can do is point to the process. Okay? And the process is to remember that the question, how do we cultivate skillful means, is a sacred question. It's a question that is worth pondering on, taking time to reflect, to meditate on, to give yourself time. Because once you start to play this game, once you start to, as everyone here presumably has, put service towards the center of your life, then the question becomes, there are a couple of questions that come. First is, how can I help? But there's a deeper question. How can I help most effectively? How can I, with my unique circumstances and situation and education and position and skills, how can I be an optimal instrument of service? That is one of our sacred questions. And it is a lifelong koan. This is a question that each of us here will probably be working with for the rest of our lives. It's bottomless. And yet there's a trap, because there's a tendency to assume we should know how we should be serving optimally. And yet it takes time. There's a beautiful example from Gandhi's life when Gandhi was approached for advice about a situation that was causing great trouble in India during the British rule there. And the British had imposed a salt tax. And the salt tax decreed that salt could only be obtained from specific sources, and it was illegal for people to obtain salt from the beaches and oceans, free salt. They had to buy it, and salt, of course, in a very hot climate, was an essential for life. So Indians were suffering, and this was a point of great resentment and contention by the Indians. And so Gandhi was approached by a group of eminent politicians and leaders as to how they should respond, what they could do. And Gandhi's response was very interesting. He said, "I don't know. But I'll go into retreat and I'll think about it. I'll reflect and I'll pray." So that's what he did. Gandhi withdrew and spent some weeks reflecting and praying on what he should do. And finally an inspiration came. And Gandhi announced that he would walk to the sea, which was hundreds and hundreds of miles away, and he would get some salt. And that's what he started to do. And as he walked across India day after day and week after week, hundreds and then thousands of people began to accompany him. And at the end of that long walk, when the world's media was focused on him, he simply came to the beach, he bathed in the ocean, he prayed, and he took one handful of salt and ate it. And the whole British Empire trembled. That's skillful reflection on optimal service. That's the use of what's the best thing I can do? How can I be a most effective instrument of service? That's the koan that each of us will be working with for the rest of our lives. So, would anyone like to comment or question?
A couple of years ago, I had an experience where I thought my life was coming to an end and had to face all of these questions you're talking about. And it was, what should I do? What should I do? If my life is almost over, what should I do? And all sorts of things came to mind, but they weren't my own ideas. They were other people's ideas. And finally I thought, well, if my life is really almost over, shouldn't it be my idea? And my idea came from Joseph Campbell, follow your bliss. Beautiful. So that's what I finally started doing.
Yes.
And I highly recommend it.
Beautiful, thank you. And it's really important to recognize, as you obviously did, that our bliss is very different from our simple happiness or from pleasure. Bliss, there's pleasure, which comes from momentary sensory sensations. There's happiness about our conditions. There's joy, which comes from our deeper being. And there's bliss, which is an aspect of our true nature. And when we follow our bliss, we're actually following the calling and expression of our true nature. So thank you. Yes.
Hi, Roger. I'm Robin.
Hi, Robin.
I wanted to just share my calling, which is to help learning disabled and emotionally disturbed children. And I teach 6th grade levels, and I manage all, you know, like about 12 different children at a time, and they're all on different grade levels. And there's quite a bit to my job, and I love this job. But what's happening for me is I have chronic fatigue, and so I'm not able to spend very much time renewing myself and doing very much a practice other than service. And so it's so nice to be here. I'm very grateful to be here and renewing myself this week. But what came up for me during the meditation was actually to work a little less, like maybe work 4 days a week, because I'm in the right calling, but I have to take care of my health and my well-being.
Yes.
And so that's what came up, and I want to be more loving in how I proceed. You know, I want my love to expand endlessly.
Beautiful.
And that's my vision. Yeah. Thank you for letting me share that.
Beautiful. Thank you. So that's an insight into the importance of service not being sacrifice. Because if you were to serve and to ruin your health, that would be sacrifice. And would not be what is most helpful either to you or to everyone in the long run. And that's, Robin's raising a really important point, because it's easy once one appreciates the ideal of service to turn it into a should and a sacrifice, and to push oneself to the point of burnout with it. The reality is, there is an ocean of suffering out there, and nothing we do will ever alleviate it all, at least in this lifetime. So it is a constant balancing act between serving as fully and effectively as we can and not overdoing it, not burning ourselves out. Because we're in this for the long run. And so it might be wonderful in theory to throw oneself in totally, you know, without taking care of oneself, but it's not the most, it's not best for oneself, and in the long run, it's not best for anyone. So thank you for that balance and for listening to the inner guidance.
just on the heels of what Robin just said, I have a story. An associate professor of mine in graduate school was an addictions counselor, and I asked her one day why she didn't burn out, because she was always, it seemed, giving 110% plus teaching at night. And she looked me in the eye and she said, "That's because I'm constantly working in the solution and not the problem," which I thought was just brilliant. And that's carried me through many years in treating. But self-care, I think Robin made a really good point about self-care and how utterly important that is. Because if we deplete ourselves, there's nothing to give.
Mm. Thank you. Okay. So, that's all for the benefits. May this priceless opportunity that we have of exploring these profound issues, of remembering our extraordinary good fortune and well-favored lives, of investigating and reflecting on some of the deepest questions and challenges and opportunities of life, may this extraordinary good fortune of ours be the means and the inspiration for our awakening, for our cultivation of skillful means, for our gratitude and joy, and for our sharing all these gifts with all beings for the welfare and awakening of all.